Mr. DeRoy, I'd like to go back and ask about your wife. Where was she from, and what has she been doing?
Well, Deborah Ann Spoor is the daughter of Peter Spoor, and she spent most of her formative years in Poughkeepsie, New York. She was born in 1935, and I guess 6 months later than my sister, who I think was born in 1934. But anyhow, they're both very close in age. Her father was in the Spoor Lash. He was one of the Spoor Lasher people, and it was an electrical construction company in Poughkeepsie, New York. They worked in and around Poughkeepsie and also other areas of New York State. They were very big in what they did. They were foremost electricians in the construction, transformers. In any event, Deb went to school in Poughkeepsie. And after she graduated, later she went to Catherine Gibbs School in Missouri, if I'm not mistaken. And of course, in Missouri, she went to Catherine Gibbs College, where she learned many things that benefit her later in life, particularly that of being a really good secretary. And of course, Catherine Gibbs School teaches young ladies to be young ladies. In the 50s, this was very appropriate. Today, I'm not sure who teaches young ladies anyway, except now. But anyhow, she then wound up in she wound up in Lancaster working for a gentleman by the name of Earl Cohen. And many people here locally remember Earl Cohen. He came to Pittsburgh, and he was one of the prime movers of the Stadium Authority. And we didn't have one. We finally did build one, starting in the early 60s. And Debbie was his secretary, started the Grant Building, and finally wound up in one of their offices in the stadium after it was built. Earl Cohen later left the stadium and became an aide to, he was an aide for a while to Joe Barr, who was his executive secretary. Deb remained with the Stadium Authority until 1971 until he got married, when Pete Flaherty wrote that job out of the budget. And of course, at that point she worked for a short period of time for a Chester roommate, who was an interior decorator in the Shadyside area, at least his offices were in the Shadyside area. She then got a job with Asphalt Products Company, which is actually one of George Merge's, my friends. That was one of his big undertakings. And she worked there until about the same time last year that I retired. She also retired because Asphalt Products had been sold to another group, and they wanted their base of operations in RSPA up near, up near Pepper. And of course, they're there now, and I didn't want her to continue working because it was just too far to commute every day.
I'd like to ask about during your married period, did you have any religious affiliation or practice? Just give us whatever you can.
No, my wife is Presbyterian and I'm Jewish. Mm-hmm. There's never been a conflict of our religious beliefs. And I've attended church. She's attended synagogue. There are no children involved. And, I think you should go through life and follow your religious pursuits. I feel that they're personal, and unless you have children, I don't think that it becomes a great issue for either one.
Was she affiliated anywhere? Were you?
Well, I'm not affiliated solidly with Rosa Shoulder, mm-hmm. but every time there's a problem, I seem to get a phone call, so I guess they know who I am. Mm-hmm. Debbie doesn't belong to any church in this particular time.
I had to ask those. back to now to your police career in some detail. Who was your first partner? What about your uniform? What beat did you have? What sort of car did you have? Or did you walk? Talk to us about your early work.
All right, well, we were in the academy up in, as I said, number 11 station on number 6 in Squirrel Hill. Jim Slusser had a detail for us, and it was on Washington Boulevard. It was about disordered gangs taking over Washington Boulevard as well as Allegheny River Boulevard and using it for drag strips. You'll remember coming out of the 50s or the middle 50s there, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler started to develop what we now call the muscle cars. They were big cubic inch cars, and they were fast. The only problem is manufacturers didn't decide to put a piece of brakes on them until the late 60s. In the interim, there had been some accidents, and several people had been seriously injured who were not involved in the drag race, but these kids got them involved in the drag race. The public was up in arms. And Jim Slusser knew that I had a driving career. I was a fast driver. I never put a dent on a car. I never had a bad accident as a result of that kind of driving. So he asked me, he said, would you pick a partner and handle this detail? Well, we did for 3 years. And we broke up several stolen car gangs where when we'd open the hood of a Chevy, we'd see a Buick engine indicating that somebody had stolen a Buick and taken the engine out of it. And they were usually late model cars so that they could even have more horsepower under the hood than what the Chevy might provide. But in any event, we worked on that for some time. John Miller and I worked together for many, many years. After 23 years in 1980, he retired, he had remarried, and moved to Florida because his wife has muscular dystrophy, and she could not stand the cold weather. I think you mentioned the beat I had. Our beats were automobile beats. However, we did walk a beat. Mine was on Lincoln Avenue. Liberty section, Warner Avenue District. I provided through the years, I was single at the time, I had the money, and I provided my own car for the city because the city had a habit of buying two-door, six-cylinder, stick-shift cars, which were very, very grossly underpowered. It was just no competition. The kids used to run away from them. So I went out and Ford, and I contacted Ford. As a matter of fact, it's the first time I met who's the chairman of the board of Chrysler right now, the president of Chrysler, Lee Iacocca. He was in charge of the Livonia, Michigan parts plant. He happened to be here visiting a fellow by the name of Bill Bingley, who had a Ford dealership right at Friendship and Palm Boulevard. And we were talking about cars. I mentioned how to make a heavy-duty pursuit car. Apparently Ford bought the idea, and it still stands to this day.
What stands?
Well, I'll tell you. Years ago, they used to have two frames for a Ford. One was a station wagon, and one was for a sedan. But Ford had never taken the sedan and put it on the Ford station wagon, which had the larger brakes, the heavier radiator, the bigger generator, the bigger wheels, the bigger shocks, and everything else. All Ford was doing in those days was protecting their investment in the station wagon because you might be the kind of guy that bought a station wagon to use as a truck. And they wanted to make sure it ran 4,000 miles in 90 days because that used to be the original guarantee. And I said, if you put a sedan body on a heavy-duty frame with all the heavy-duty components, you'd have a good taxi cab and you'd have a damn dynamite car. You know, really good car. And they did it and found out that it worked. And then 1959 was the first one they came out with their so-called quote-unquote police package and their taxi package, which was the same thing. And they found out that they got a lot of mileage out of the cars, had no frame trouble, had no radiator trouble, the larger battery that they had in the station wagon was now in the sedan, and it was the greatest thing that ever happened. And it just worked out well. Anyhow, I was rewarded by, I bought a car, one of the cars that I bought, the 59 Ford, it had an interceptor engine, and it was a stick shift, but it looked like every other city car. And that's exactly what I wanted. And it had a two-way radio, and I provided my own two-way radios as well as my lights and sirens.
Could you simplify that? You told him that if he took the station wagon's
frame,
that it would get on.
put a sedan body on it and put be building a stronger car. And they did. So, anytime anybody saw whichever one I liked. But anyhow, I provided my own cars, and I guess I became a legend among the kids and a lot of older people growing up through the years.
Did they pay you for the car?
City pay, oh yes, they certainly did. They never hesitated to give me $25 a month. Mm-hmm. But actually, they paid my partner too, and that was $50 a month, so I was able to buy the gas and everything else. No, they didn't pay for the car. No, I paid for that. That's all I needed, a car anyway. If I took a vacation, the car went, and it wasn't in service until I came back from vacation. I owned it. And believe it or not, all the chasing and the rest we made, all the other grease work we did with the car, wasn't any harder on it. And I had the convenience of having my own two-way radio, and I had all the emergency equipment, including fire extinguishers and what have you. But in any event, I was driving my own car for the city. At one time, the inspectors didn't get cars for the city. They had to drive their own. Mm-hmm. The city would not provide it in that car.
Let me ask you, when did you, or if you, did you encounter Tony Grosso?
Sure, I knew Tony Grosso. I knew him well.
When?
In 1959, one of my details from Slusser's office was find Grosso's headquarters. Now, we knew damn well the number's headquarters was not in the city. And what we had to do is we had to follow this numbers writer, this pickup man, and so on and so forth. And we had four men on the detail. And we did this day in and day out. Some days we were happy, other days we weren't. But anyhow, one day out at the Castle Shannon streetcar stop, we saw a station wagon pull out of the lot, and it just had in the windows, general contractor. No phone number, no address, nothing else. And we saw some people who I didn't know. My partner, not John Miller, but another partner I was working with at that time, recognized one of the men as a numbers writer. Get in that car. So they said, well, let's follow. And we did. And it wound up clear in Whitehall. It wound up in one of the boroughs or townships on Old Clareton Road. And we saw the car pull in the building garage.
But you just tailed it.
Yes, sure. And we saw the door to that. Mm-hmm. And we parked there many, many days, and they had three or four headquarters. And they'd use this one today and that one tomorrow and so on and so forth. We decided to use this one. We were going to hit this one because it, out there on Old Clareton Road, and I can't remember the, well, Jefferson Borough is where it was. Jefferson Borough, we were well outside the city. And we figured it took a couple months, and we found out every Friday they used that particular house. And Friday was a good day because they had all the slips for the whole weekend. By God, we set it up, and we got a county detective to go with us to give us the authority to be outside the city, and we hit it. And we found all the adding machines and everything that you might find in a numbers headquarters. It's probably one of the biggest busts. Of course, Tony was strictly tied because Aaron L. Gruber, who was my cousin, was painting a mural in his living room out there in Bethel Park at the same time. And Tony was always upset. He says, I can't understand. He says, I got half the family painting a mural and the other half the family's trying to put me in jail. He says, I don't know what to do about this.
So, did he offer you anything?
Never. There was never any offer. He knew better than offering me money in all the 35 years that I worked as a police officer and a police official. And yet may go back this fall again because I've already been contacted by the new administration. I was never interested in taking money.
There's a difference between taking it, being interested, and being offered it.
Well, I never was interested in taking it. I was never offered it.
You're never offered it?
Probably. I was never offered it.
In Pittsburgh, it's almost impossible, not offered.
No, it's a reputation, a procedure. You know, if you offered me money, if you were a numbers man, I said, that's the first time, and the answer is no. If there's a second time, it's bribery, you go to jail. There's never a second time. And that's exactly the way I operate. I don't need that kind of money. I don't want to create the obligations. And I don't think any police officer, you know, or any good politician, I can't speak for all politicians anymore, and I can speak for all policemen, judges, or anyone else. But that's the way most people feel. As long as you're free and clear of no obligations, you can perform your job and you can do it. And they may hate your guts, but they have a lot of respect for you.
Yeah, well, How much of a problem is the bribery among the police officers in Pittsburgh?
Bribery is almost nil in almost all major cities, including Pittsburgh, because the Federal Bureau of Investigation has what is known as the RICO Act, and any politician, elected official or appointed official, police officers and appointed official, that's involved in taking any kind of money, and in other words, it prevents him from doing his
that's
job.
That's only since RICO. You go back before
I'm talking, now wait a second, now we're talking about currently, I'll go back in a second. No one, you know, we could take any money that they will wind up under federal investigation. So that was one of the best laws that I think they ever passed, was the RICO Act. If you're talking about 30 years or 40 years ago, that was a way of life in every police force, with every ward chairman, with every alderman, and make it Chicago, make it Pittsburgh, make it Philadelphia, make it Baltimore, New York. That was the way things ran. Now you take some of the major cities today, they're going to have problems with that. They don't have problems in the city of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we were, as a matter of fact, I did put one of my policemen in jail, a fellow by the name of Art Williams. I knew he was selling cocaine on his job as a police officer. We couldn't investigate him. Hell, he knew all of us. But I got the DEA to send in some people, and by God, it was just recently, we read the newspaper, about 12 to 24 years. And a $1,000 fine, whatever that's indicative of, I have no idea. But anyhow, he'll be in for 12 years.
The time is what?
Well, that's it. But see, he can't, you know, with a felony like that, he was involved
that's
in narcotics.
That's pretty rare.
But nevertheless, he's the only one that there was sufficient proof.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure that from time to time, people walk tight ropes. I'm sure the judges do. I'm sure everyone else. The criminal justice system in this country is not working as it should. But it's not because of bribery. Because it's a strict adherence, you know, to silly rules and regulations that have been promulgated by the courts of this nation that don't allow something to be introduced. In other words, because somebody said it was illegally obtained, when in fact it would have been discovered, you know, a month or two down the road anyhow. But see, when I came on the job, we didn't have Matt versus Ohio. In other words, no matter how...
What is that?
Well, no matter how you obtained evidence, when I became a police officer, I could introduce it against you in a court of law. There was no limitation.
Mm-hmm.
However, in 1961, Matt versus Ohio came. And they said, oh no, that was a federal regulation that the courts used for their federal investigators, your FBI, your Secret Service, and all of that. We're now going to extend that down into the state courts. The state of New York, the state of Pennsylvania, Ohio, we had no exclusionary rule. You couldn't exclude any evidence that policemen obtained, even though it wasn't exactly right. But I don't know what illegally obtained evidence is. And it's very, very difficult. Identify it. But nevertheless, we had to start following that rule in 1961 in the Warren Court. It's a game today, unfortunately, in court. It isn't a search for the truth like it was when I was a younger police officer.
You know, wasn't it true, though, about when you started that every policeman on his beat could eat in any restaurant on his beat or take any apples or wherever? I don't know.
I got many cups of coffee.
I'm not sure that's bad.
No, I got many cups of coffee I never paid for. At Eaton Park, because all these drag racers worked there. And every so often they said, you guys want to, you know, it was 2 o'clock in the morning. They didn't close till 4
you're
o'clock.
You're providing law and order.
Well, no. He said, would you guys want a hamburger? Yeah. And I never turned down a free hamburger. But there was no strings attached, and he was well aware of that. And that's what Eaton Park wanted. And they took care of the district people that went in there for a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Policemen never paid for coffee. And another one, I don't know if you've been here, remember Mark Betts used to be right there
sure.
at the farm or Baum and Negley?
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, we always went in there and got a hamburger and a cup of coffee. We never paid. Because all night long, policemen were in and out of that place and it never got held up.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess maybe there is something. Of course, a lot of people say, oh, that's terrible. You ought to pay for everything, but these are dreams. They live in a dream world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to allude to another non-Spur Hill station and the black, colored, niggers. What has been your police experience?
The black community?
Black.
Okay, number one, when we first started in the middle 50s, we worked Homewood Russian. And we found many of the families there. Both white and black lived together in perfect harmony. And those were the days that on Sunday, white kids or black kids out in that community. There weren't any along Larmer Avenue because that was all Italian at that time. But they wore white shirts and they went to church and they were God-fearing people. There was no question about it. And there was there was none of this racial prejudice that you see today. And what has happened through many of the laws that I think have been passed on civil rights, a lot of people are under the impression that they're forcing me to like a group that I don't care to like. In other words, I think the public really, really feels this way. But in any event, we worked out there and we got more good information from the black community only because we worked the same hours out there every day of the week. And they knew DeRoy and Miller and the Black Ford, you know, and they called the station which was number 6. It was 5 originally, and it became number 6.
Where was that station?
What, number 6?
Yeah.
That's the one down the street here.
Down the street where? Speaking.
Where, in East Liberty. Oh, okay, well. I guess I better get a lot in block plans. But in any event, the idea was they would call number 5 station originally, now number 6 at the same time, number 11 became number 6. And they would ask, you know, to see Mr. Dewar and Mr. Miller the night at the station. And of course, when we came to work, we met them and they had problems in their community. And we always helped people out, whether they were black or white. It wasn't a matter of being black or white to us. It wasn't a matter of prejudice, you know, or like or dislike. It was there a violation of the law and couldn't the arrest be made? And of course, it's funny how that followed up until the time that, I guess it was Martin on April 4th, 1968, when Martin Luther King was assassinated. From that time on, if uniformed police officers and Homewood Russian would walk into a bar, they were met with physical resistance. Yet my partner and I, in plain clothes in an unmarked car, could walk in that bar, people would move aside, let us in, grab the guy we wanted, and walk out. If he gave us any trouble, they'd grab him and walk him to the car with us until they got in. In other words, I think if police officers work in a given area long enough, get to be known, and the terms don't rotate. One of the two things that happened in the police departments is we became too mobilized, and we started to rotate terms because a couple crybabies said, well, I can't spend time with my family. Well, let me tell you something. If you want to work in this day and age, whether you can spend time with your family or not is of no concern of mine. In other words, if your seniority allows you to work anything, you know, when you first come on, other than night turn, then good, you pick that. And if it's afternoon turn, then if you can go, you go to daylight. I don't care what you do. But leave the turns the same so that the public out there sees that same car, and when they see that same car every day, they'll see the same people in it. I think you'll have a much better police force. And if I go back, I'm procrastinating on that. I'm not sure at this point if I wanted to throw all that aggravation again, although I have requested you think it over. That's one of the things I'm going to do. I want the same people working the same God bless it turn every day in the same station so that those people see the same thing.
When you were made inspector, where were you and what did you do?
Well, originally I was a lieutenant in 1964, and Dave Craig, who was the safety director at that time, said, you're going out to number 5 station in East Liberty, and you're going to become an inspector. And I didn't want to be an inspector because I was having too much fun being a lieutenant. So I stonewalled it as long as I could. Of course, there was another little, you know, minus to this. When you were the inspector at number 5 station, you also had number 6 station. You had 2 stations, so you had to run both of them. And at one time, they had a station downtown and one on the hill, and you had to run those two also. So I said, all right, finally, I had to go out there. But I thought the interesting thing was, I said, but I'm going to do it as a lieutenant. He said, well, you're an acting inspector. And then he called me several times after I was out there, and apparently I was running very successfully. And I had the support of the people at both stations. And of course, in those days, the stations had a lot more policemen than they do today.
What year was that about? 68?
Oh, no, this was still 1965. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, one day he said, "You're going to be an inspector." I said, "No, I'm not. I'm going to run this." See, I was always suspicious because if I was a lieutenant, I was under civil service, they couldn't fire me. But in those days, if you became an inspector and assistant superintendent, they could fire you. And I didn't want to be fired. I'd only been on 6 or 7 years. And one day I got a call from the governor's office, Dave Lawrence. And he said, "You meet me, you know, down in the Civic Building," because this time he was no longer governor of Pennsylvania. You were only allowed to run 4 years in those days. He had left the governorship in 64 and gone with LBJ, Lyndon Johnson. And he was serving as one of the secretaries in the cabinet of Johnson. But anyway, I went down to see him. And I said, "Do you want to see the governor?" It was on a Saturday morning. He said, "Yes." He said, "What is this rabbit poop that you won't be an inspector?" He said, "Do you know, I've been the mayor of the city for many years. People would kill for that job. I know how, you know, and you don't want it." He said, "Wait a second." He says, "You're going to take that job." And I said, "But, you know, Governor, I don't want that job." He said, "You're going to take the job." He pounded his desk and everything flew up in the air. And right then and there, I didn't even think my civil service protection was any good because I thought it was just a firing on the spot. So I acquiesced and I accepted the job. And there was no problem. But little did I know there's history to that. When I wanted to become a police officer and I was on the civil service list and I was due to be made a police officer, my family, including Jim Slusser, about 20 of them went in. Friends of my folks to tell the mayor, "Don't allow me to be a police officer." And he's looking at the list. He said he's third from the top of the list. He made 107, which was actually 97 of my 10 veterans points. He said, "There's nothing I can do." And he went on and on, and they're saying, "But you're the mayor of this city. You're one of the best politicians we've ever had." And that's the first time Dave Lawrence ever had to stand up and say, "Wait a second, I want you people to realize I'm only the mayor of the city." In other words, he had to demean himself to become practically nothing because there wasn't a thing he could do about me being on the civil service, plus the fact that I knew Dave Lawrence very well in my own right. And he liked me. He used to watch me loaf with the police, and he thought I'd be a good policeman. But there was nothing he could do. And he made up his mind at that time, if there's ever going to be a chance for advancement for that kid, and he makes a lieutenant, I'm going to make him an inspector because I'm going to make all those people eat their words. Because they embarrassed me because I had to tell them I was only the mayor of the city. And that was exactly what happened.
That's a good story.
And that's a true anecdote. Mm-hmm. And I realized what was happening at that time.
Yeah, I love David Lawrence's story. So many people do.
Yeah, he was a true politician. He was good. He was true to his word. And I think that it's very difficult. The politicians don't have the power and authority that he had or Daley. And I knew Daley real well. From Chicago. He used to come here to Pittsburgh because his son was going with a girl out in Bethel Park, who is now the mayor of Chicago and who married the girl from Bethel Park. And he used to come and tell us police stories from Chicago, and he had his police sergeant with him. It was very, very good. But we got to know these people, and we were very relaxed with him. I was relaxed with David Lawrence.
Yeah, what was the basis of Lawrence's special strength or power or something?
The numbers.
I mean, they loved him personally.
They liked him and respected him. They said, "Here's a guy that came from the first ward down there, you know, which would be now the first ward is practically all of Point State Park. Pulled himself up by his bootstraps and had some visions for a city. And we're going to help him with those visions." So you had all the industrial leaders of this town really felt that they wanted to clean the atmosphere here, get rid of all the smoke, and let's do something with this city because it was a great city. Lawrence was, that's all his vision was all his life. And he followed through until he suddenly died at Cyril Moss giving him a speech one night. But he felt very keenly about the city.
But the Mellons could not have been personal friends of his.
They didn't invite him to every cocktail party.
Exactly.
But nevertheless, the mayor of the city is still a very, very important person to know, even for somebody that's a millionaire over and over again.
Right.
And I think that's the position I find myself in. Because if I have an entree with the mayor, then I'll bet I have an entree with the governor, and if necessary, with the president.
Well, does Sophie have the same relationship with anybody?
I have no idea.
I don't think
there are nobody industrialists anymore. these big corporations like Mellon and all the rest, Mellon was pulled all their stock out of Gulf Oil, and then suddenly that went down the tubes. And Mellon Bank, they've had it rough recently too from some Vanover Republic investments. Who the hell else do we have? We have
the chairman of Westinghouse.
Westinghouse, we have PPG, we have
USX.
Any of the ones you can think of, particularly USX. And unfortunately, it's just one of those things that, there is no dynamic industrialism anymore. They're just leveraged buyouts. And the people that get them, they're pretty good of no consequence except they have a lot of money.
Well, then the mayor doesn't relate to these people.
I don't think the mayor doesn't relate to those people. Those people don't relate to the mayor. They don't understand what the hell this city's about because they're not local. Remember, the people with U.S. Steel were all locals at one time. I mean, that was Frick, and that was Frick, that was Mellon, that was... Shenley, that was all of these people, and who the hell, and Frick, all of these people. You know, they were local people. Mm-hmm. They were born and raised here, and they felt an obligation in Carnegie, for God's sake, to